This morning we are introducing one of the last stories that we're going to get before the entire narrative of the book of Genesis shifts, and that is the story of the Tower of Babel. This is the last story that is going to be set in a very distant and remote ancient history, even by the time of Abraham. I mean, by the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that the world is already for them quite old. As we'll read in Abraham's story, nations such as Babylon will have already risen and fallen and then risen again. Egypt will already be established, and a pharaoh will be introduced to relatively quickly in Abraham's story. This is the last of that ancient world that existed before the flood and that assembled itself after the flood. So this is going quite a ways back. And we're beginning here with this genealogy, which is frankly how ancient peoples would have told a bit of history and recounted the time before or their history. There's enough important information here, I think, contained in, and there's a central idea that I really want us to fix on in reading of this genealogy. And so while I had planned to try and lump this in with the tower and teach it as one whole cohesive story, I figured it was worth considering the state of the world that the Tower of Babel comes from, and really try to get a handle on a genealogy like this, which for us is a challenge to understand and to see what's happening. And we can feel so distant and remote. We're unfamiliar with these names and these places that it was worthwhile to just stop, pause, and to consider one of the major issues that arises from this text. And that is simply this. This morning we're going to consider how shortly after this great act of deliverance, God delivering Noah and his family through the ark, that so soon after, it appears as though the whole world has forgotten the flood and the God who has saved mankind. The nations have come to forget. And as John Calvin points out, that is an egregious thing. He says this in commenting on these verses. He says, "This second commencement of mankind is especially worthy to be known, and detestable is the ingratitude of those who, when they had heard from their fathers and grandfathers of the wonderful restoration of the world in so short a time, that they yet voluntarily became forgetful of the grace and the salvation of God. Even the memory of the deluge was by the greater part entirely lost. Very few cared by what means or for what end they had been preserved." And that really is the story taking place in the unveiling of this long genealogy. We hear of the sons of Noah and how their descendants went to father many nations. And what's striking about this story is, well, what's missing? And what is lacking? There's not much mention of the Lord God Yahweh, and what the children of men seem to get up to in these generations following the flood should for us serve as a warning and set off the alarms for us. So I want us to consider these passages. I'll try to make sense of some of this, highlight the things that are really important for us to understand, and then tie it into where we're headed for the narrative of the Tower of Babel moving forward. So the first thing I want us to see from this story is point number one, very simply, the sons of Noah. The sons of Noah. The next division in Genesis appears right there at the beginning of 10. That familiar phrase, "these are the generations of the sons of Noah." And it's an important way to set up the staging and the framing for this recreated world history. As we've been pointing out over and over since we started the flood stories, is that we have a recapitulation, a retelling, a recreation of the world. And that story does indeed continue here, and it does mirror in many ways what came before. The three sons of Noah that we were introduced to over the last few weeks are Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And as we begin to trace out the history of the renewed humanity, I want us to notice and to clearly see how two of the sons, who in the last story regarding Noah and his vineyard and Ham uncovering his father's nakedness, the two sons who are supposed to be the heroes of the story and who are held in who maintain a good reputation, that they're lumped together first. I'm going to examine them because they seem to forget. By the time they start having sons and their sons have sons, there's hardly any mention anymore of these men being faithful and their families being faithful to Yahweh who saved them. The first son I want us to take a look at is Japheth, beginning there in verse 2. Now, Japheth, if you count up all of the names, he goes on to have seven sons. And then of those seven sons, there are seven additional grandsons who are named. And all the names that are listed here throughout the entire genealogy, these are the names of those who would go on to be founders of communities, clans, it keeps repeating, fathers of clans and nations. And many of these names and the locations of them are very foreign to us, but thankfully there's a whole history in the church to draw from. There are great scholars and people who study these things to draw from. And it's very, very clear that based on the descriptions that are given here and the names of the places, because quite often, you know, the name of a figure would also be the name of the location, which also was happened to be the name many times of the god, because the kings and the rulers were worshipped as God. All this evidence helps us to see that these people in particular are many of the clans and many of the nations that lie to the north of Israel. And the sons of Japheth really are the people who constitute the furthest nations, the nations that are at the ends of the earth or of the known world to the time of this writing. It says once again in verse 5 that from these, the coastland people spread in their lands, each with their own language by their clans in their nations. And so really when we're thinking of those of the coastlands, if you imagine Israel and the Mediterranean Sea in your mind, if you imagine that, and these would be the peoples to the north, going up through Syria and then north into modern day Turkey. If you consider the north of where Israel is located at present, this would include lands to the west, also going into Greece or the island of Cyprus, which just lies in the Mediterranean. Also, this would be the peoples that lie to the east, so to the northeast of modern day like Armenia or some of the most northern parts of Iran. These are peoples who live quite far away, and the peoples who most often don't play a significant role in the story of Israel as the Old Testament unfolds. That many of these people are quite distant. There are some who get engaged in secondary conflicts. There is some relation to the coastland people and the sea peoples, of which the Philistines were one of the peoples of the sea peoples who come and occupy parts of the promised land. But overall, these are the people described as the ends of the earth, outside of the immediate area. Well, if that's one of the sons who's clearly forgotten, we also want to, unfortunately, take a look at the sons of Shem in verse 21. To Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the elder brother of Japheth, children were born, we're told in verse 21. Now, Shem will go on to have, or five of his sons are listed as well as five grandsons, and then the 16 additional descendants that are listed. Now, even though in the text, there's one name that really is highlighted, and we just read it there in verse 21, and that is the fact that Shem is the father of all children to Eber, or Eber. The reason why he's significant is that what this is trying to communicate is that Eber would have been the father of of the ethnic Hebrews, Eber, is related to the word Hebrew. And that's what the scriptures are presenting, that it's from this line, from this man, that the Hebrews are born. But what's important to note about that is that even as the Hebrews are being, as an ethnic group, are being born and are settling, once again, they're settling as clans and as peoples, as we're told in the Far East. So their territory in verse 30, in which they live, extended to Mesha in the direction of Sephar, and that is way out to the east, close to where Babylon is going to be and Assyria. These are people who are very remote and distant, and as far as we can tell by the text, really maintain no relation to the God of their father and to the God of Noah. Whereas in the previous story, Noah proclaims, "Blessed be the Lord Yahweh, the God of Shem." There's no mention here, and they end up dwelling in a place far away. These people will be the people from whom we can trace the line to Abram, or who will become Abraham. But once again, these people are not necessarily distinctly God-fearers. If anything, by the time we get to the Tower of Babel, they will be the people from which this group comes from, will be part of that massive humanity, which is of one mind and of one accord and seeks to build the tower. Now, one of the confusing things about reading a genealogy like this is the issue of timing for us, right? So this genealogy goes up to the time of the tower and then goes far beyond the tower, right? Because we keep hearing how these are peoples and clans and nations, how they have their distinct languages. Well, that only happens after the tower. But within the genealogy, we get this verse. Well, there's two figures associated with the tower, actually. We get these verses to know, okay, when did the tower happen? And when did this divide take place? And one of them, according to the line of Shem, is found in verse 25. If you look down at verse 25, it says that to Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg. And then right after, it says this, "For in his days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan." So it's right there. In the days that the earth was divided, in his day, so when Peleg was alive, it's at that point that the tower existed, was constructed, and the people's languages were confused and humanity was divided. And so after Peleg, the line of Shem continues, and we see several more generations that are descended from that particular time and period. These two figures, Japheth and Shem, constitute a whole group of people, some which will be very familiar to us, obviously the Hebrews, some which one is all, but both of them categorized by this idea of having forgotten the Lord and forgotten what was promised unto them by their father when he blessed them and when he cursed his brother. But these two in the text very clearly do serve a secondary purpose, though, because the main focus is found for us in verses 6 all the way to 20, and that is focusing on the line of Ham. So the second thing I want us to see, we'll move quicker, is the line of Ham. Ham's lineage is put right there in the middle. There's focus for us, there's emphasis there, and that's where we get a lot of important detail regarding what's happening here and how to understand this passage. Now to Ham, there's born four sons, the last of which is Canaan, who we read about last week. 24 grandsons and two great-grandsons are all listed here. And they are centrally important, not just here in this genealogy, but they're going to play a major role throughout the rest of the Old Testament, because it's Ham's descendants that form the primary adversaries for Israel and God's people. all those groups that we know from our Old Testament stories, they descend from Ham, and they're listed in some ways here in this genealogy. We'll walk through some of it. Most obviously, in verses 6 and 13, is the naming of Egypt, who will go on to found that great civilization in Egypt to the south of Israel. Secondly, quite obvious as well, is Canaan himself. So the name Canaan, which is where the land of Canaan derives its name, he has several other, there are several other clans and sons that constitute the people that will occupy the land of Canaan in verses 15 to 19. So Canaan fathers Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Akites, the Sinites, and more and more and more ites. Now, those should be very familiar to us because those names appear over and over and over. I mean, when Moses is given instructions by the Lord to, like, marching orders to go into the promised land, and then when they're told to go in and to clear out the nations occupying the land of promise, it's all of these clans and these peoples, the descendants of Canaan directly. And being descendants of Canaan, then obviously they carry with them a particular curse, and they bring with them all sorts of wickedness and spiritual warfare as well. Because it's to these people, to these individual ones, it's to these, all these clans, these groups that are occupying the land of Canaan, that the particular wickedness associated with the Nephilim and giants and stuff like that start to be drawn out. Ham's descendants are notable because they, above all of the descendants, are the ones who are most compromised with wicked spiritual and pagan practice. I mean, everyone was pagan, but these guys were particularly wicked, and it is through the sons of Ham that we do see the return of the figures of the giants or the Nephilim. That's very clearly laid out for us as it describes this guy Nimrod in verses 8 through 9. Verses 8 through 9, we see we're introduced to the descendants of Cush, who fathered Nimrod. He was the first on earth to be a mighty man. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, it tells us. And that phrase for mighty man, it's the same thing that was used previously for speaking of the Nephilim, who were the mighty men of old. It's the same idea in the Septuagint version of the Old Testament, which is again a Greek translation, but it's a very early translation of the Old Testament. So the Greek Septuagint even predates some of the Hebrew manuscripts that we have up until recently. That term is translated as giant. Like these are the giants. So Nimrod is the one who was a giant, which means that he's a particularly cruel and powerful ruler, that he's particularly wicked, and that he would be something like a bit of a warlord. Verses 10 to 12 describes how it is Nimrod that begins his kingdom in Babylon, and Akkad, the Akkadian area, and Kelna in the land of Shinar. This is the region and the realm of ancient Babylon. This is describing and naming Nimrod as the founder of the Babylonian Empire, the first Babylonian Empire. And that is frankly what the Tower of Babel, as we'll see next week, is all about. This first grand civilization established by Nimrod, the wicked. Now, it's easy to overlook what's happening and why this is important, so I'm going to try to spell it out for us real quick. Remember, we've been dealing since the flood with the recreation story once again, and that everything that began in the flood is being brought to a similar conclusion as all that happened before, after the fall in the garden leading up to the flood. So what happened in the first section of Genesis? There's a creation, Then there's a fall. Adam sins, and then his son Cain also sins and kills his brother Abel. And Cain is cursed and exiled, exiled away. And what does Cain do? Well, Cain goes on to found the first great civilization, a pre-flood civilization. And Cain and his descendants, they bring about the first city, and they're fashioning tools and weapons. But they are fundamentally a wicked people. And it's this wicked people who start to come under demonic influence. And from their perversions, it's the Nephilim which come forth, born of the union of the sons of God and the daughters of man. And again, that union is thought is best thought of as a result of just wicked paganism and spiritual union, which comes about through rites and rituals. And we'll talk about that more next week as well. Well, where humanity ends up at that point is, the Bible tells us, the man's heart was only evil all the time, only evil continually. And then what does God do to judge? He brings about a flood. When we come to the story after the flood, history is repeating itself. We see the same sorts of thing. God recreates, right? He refashions the earth. He divides the waters again. But immediately, in a garden-like state, as close to a garden as you're gonna get in this age, Noah and his son Ham sin, and then Ham's line, his descendants, are cursed. And what does a descendant of Canaan end up doing? This guy Nimrod. Well, he goes on to found a great civilization, a great city like Cain before him, and there's somehow a relationship between the founding of this civilization with this spiritual perversion, which brings about a return of the giants, the Nephilim, him being a mighty man. The same is true of all those sons of Canaan, all of those who come under judgment, severe judgment, so far where they have to be exterminated, are under the same sort of demonic and evil influence. All of mankind, halfway through this genealogy, is united in this wickedness under Babylon, or under Nimrod in Babylon. And just as the first time humanity built this civilization and wickedness spun out of control, God had to judge, what's going to happen here? Well, the Tower of Babel is going to be God's judgment against humanity. Now, he promised he wouldn't judge the world by water and flood it again and destroy it again. And so that's why the Tower of Babel is this different kind of judgment. But it is a judgment nevertheless, for the same types of reasons that Cain came under judgment. Very clearly, Nimrod is associated with this return of demonic pagan practices and sinfulness and being worshipped as a god, as all ancient rulers would have been. As one commentator notes, the name Nimrod has either been connected with the god Marduk, the patron god of Babylon, or more likely the god Ninurta. And you can even hear some of the similarities in the words, the god of hunting and the god of war. It's no coincidence then that Nimrod is noted as being this mighty hunter, a great hunter. This genealogy, even though it's a little hard to see, it's a little unclear, sets us up so that at least midway through the nations disperse, well, the world is looking a lot like it did just before the flood. Same sorts of problems. Everyone has forgotten why the flood happened. Everyone has forgotten the Lord. Leaders and rulers like Nimrod are given over to wicked spiritual practices and demonic influence, and man is seeking to establish a name for himself. So the last thing I want us to see this morning, that is point number three, setting the stage for Babel. Setting the stage for Babel. Of note, in this genealogy, in the full scope of the genealogy, there are, this is often called like the Table of Nations. And this is a complete table. And we know that that's the author's intent by using the number 70. And if you add up all the names of all of the descendants here who would have been fathers or heads over a clan or a nation, the number is 70. And as we've read in places like in Revelation, the number of seven is associated with completeness or wholeness. So when the letters go out to the seven churches, while there were certainly more churches and more congregations by that time, seven is representative of the whole and completeness. Well, the same thing here. There are 70 nations, which is trying to represent the whole humanity, or like all the nations upon the earth. And if that's the case, we have the completeness of we're thinking of all of the nations. There's one name in particular who is missing in this list, and that is Israel. Israel is not included because Israel doesn't exist. And by all accounts, in particular at the Tower of Babel and then shortly after, there is no more fearing of God. One of the great divergences between this story and everything that happened before the flood is that even as things were bad before the flood, there was always some sort of remnant. There was always some continuity, right? So, so for example, Abel and then after Abel, Seth would be in contrast to Cain, and there would be a line. And when we read the genealogy of Seth, there were those who were described as the people who began to call upon the name of the Lord. And figures like Enoch walked with God and then was taken up and never saw corruption. Or during the days of Noah, we have Noah, a man who was righteous in all his generations. And even though everything was like terrible and wicked, God still preserved a remnant. But here, after the flood, and as is evidenced by Babel, humanity comes together in Babylon in utter rebellion. And there isn't any dissenting voice any longer. It's almost as if the line of promise is dead and has died. That's really where the story is headed or has been heading. That the hope for humanity has been snuffed out for the sake of humanity. And what it's going to take for God to restore the fortunes for his people of promise is that he's going to have to raise it from the dead. That is going to be the story of Abraham. That Abraham is not like his family. By the time we meet him as Abram, they're in Babylon, in Ur, which is the greatest city in Babylon at that time, and they are participating in pagan worship and sacrifice. And God, though, has to call him out and choose him, set him apart for a particular purpose. God will have to make something of him and restore a line. And the reason why that's important for us as Christians living however many centuries ago from this particular, millennia, is that even Israel that we think of as this nation, even Israel in its founding is going to be made up of people that are called from the nations. That the inheritance that's going to belong to Israel even is one that has to be graced and given by God to people. And for us, to enter into God's community, his people of promise, his seed, the seed of the woman, to come in by this kind of election or this kind of promise delivered, God selecting you, that's an encouraging thought. Because we too have been united to God's people and called out amongst the nations through our faith in Christ. His people has always been constituted in this way. So for us, there's, in many sense, a bit of a warning there to never just follow along in the path of the nations, to never just join in with where humanity is headed. And we're gonna catch that story in its fullness next week. But while that's all true, even from the opening pages of Scripture and the earliest history of our people and the earliest history of our God is a God of the resurrection, that he will stay true to his promises and to his purposes, even if he has to raise life from the dead. He will do it. This is the story of Christ's cross and his resurrection, told in shadowy form as it comes to us from this ancient history. And as people who hear this and receive this, may it embolden our faith and our trust in God, knowing that he will raise not just all the things in our life that we want to get restored and that we want to have fixed, but he will raise even us on that last day. And it is a certainty, because he's been operating the same way with humanity since the beginning. Be eager, Christian, to go out into the world likewise and to call people to life, even those who you would presume dead. God has raised us, Christ. He has raised our people from the beginning, and he's still about the same business today. Our conversion and our faithfulness to Christ is very much a transfer from one kingdom to another, as we read in the book of Colossians, and changing your allegiance and being plucked out of the mass of humanity. Well, let's continue to give God our praises and our thanks for the way in which he works, even as we continue in our worship here this morning. Let's pray.